Hi, and welcome to Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. I'm Chris Garlock. The Labor Radio Podcast Network has grown to almost 40 shows now. You can find them all at laborradionetwork.org or use the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And this week, we're featuring three new member shows.
So, of course, our firefighters and paramedics are used to risking their lives and safety every day when they go to work, and that's not anything new. But the sheer scope of the virus, combined with the lack of PPE in some communities, and the fact that the virus is still so new, I think, really creates a unique situation and a very anxiety-provoking situation that many of our members may not have countered in their careers before.
Hosted by Mark Treglio and Doug Stern, the IAFF podcast provides news and notes from the International Association of Firefighters, the IAFF, which represents over 320,000 professional firefighters and EMS personnel across the United States and Canada. The podcast just launched in mid-March of this year, and in their latest episode, Doug and Mark talk with members of the Firefighters Health and Safety Division about their behavioral health initiatives during COVID-19.
I wake, start the factory humming. I work late, keep the whole world running. And I got something coming. Whopper, whopper, whopper.
That's from the Working People podcast, hosted by McKenna Alvarez. Working People bills itself as a podcast by, for, and about the working class today. We've also got a quick teaser from our very latest network member, an exciting new podcast called En Masse that's dedicated to telling stories of struggle and hope from the working class. We've also got a short clip from UCOM Live, where the Texas AFL-CIO's Ed Sills talked about whether COVID-19 will result in more organizing for workers in Texas. Plus, on Labor History in 2, we find out about the day in 1972 when employees of the Farah Manufacturing Company went out on strike, launching one of the iconic boycotts of the era. That's all ahead on this week's edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. First up, here's that quick teaser from En Masse. This is from episode 4, My Father Swore the Kitchen Blue, which will be posted this coming Friday, May 15th.
There's a whole clan of us Fernandez in town, all from Santander, Spain. I've never been there. My folks came over 29 years ago. A baby brother of mine, their first baby, crossed halfway with them. An epidemic broke out on board. Some fever. My brother died when they were 5 days out. My mother made my father go to the kitchen and ask the cook for a bottle, and she made him fill it with ocean water. It was all she could ever see of the baby's grave, she said. It's still in her dresser drawer at home. She takes it out on All Souls Day and Memorial Day and sets a bouquet before it.
That was a teaser from episode 4 of the new podcast En Masse, hosted by Liz Medina. Liz is an interdisciplinary artist, labor activist, and political educator who beautifully brings together oral histories and social theory. In her podcast, she says she's trying to maintain a cultural space for working people to reflect on our lives, recognizing ourselves as agents of change and makers of history. You can find previous episodes, including the current one, There Was Never Trouble Getting a Job, at enmassepodcast.com. That's E-N-M-A-S-S-E podcast.com. Or, of course, look for them on your favorite podcast platform. Next up, a short clip from UCOM Live as host Chris LaGrange talks with the Texas AFL-CIO's Ed Sills about whether COVID-19 will result in more organizing for workers in Texas.
Will this turn into organizing for Texas in the future, where you can go ahead and say, listen, those who had a voice on the job were protected during COVID, the rest of you weren't?
Okay, Chris, that's an incredibly important point. The people who are able to negotiate with management on a formal basis are going to be able to sit down when something that's as important as this happens and discuss what the working conditions are going to be. We are seeing eyes opened when people look at what labor unions are able to do compared to non-union workplaces. And I do think that this is going to result in organizing. I'm not able to put a finger on what the numbers are going to be or what it's going to look like, but the unions in Texas have been noticed during this, without any question.
That was the Texas AFL-CIO's Ed Sills on UCOM Live. Find out more at ucomlive.com or your favorite podcast platform. In the latest episode of the IAFF podcast, the new podcast from the International Association of Firefighters, hosts Mark Treglio and Doug Stern talk with members of the Firefighters Health and Safety Division about how their members are dealing with the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Welcome to another edition of the IAFF podcast. I'm your host, Mark Treglio, Assistant to the General President for Communications, Media, and Strategic Campaigns. Joining me today is my co-host, Doug Stern, Director of Strategic Campaigns and Media Relations for the International Association of Firefighters.
Hi, everybody. Hope everybody's doing well.
Doug, you know, we have a special show today, and not just in terms of the importance of this subject for our members, but it also goes to show the value that the IFF provides to its members and the innovation that comes out of headquarters and the resources that we offer. And that's about behavioral health. Over the last 5 to 6 to 8 years or so, the IFF's really taken strides to focus on its members' health, not just physically in terms of muscle strains and pulls and injured necks and backs, but more now on the mental side of things and the behavioral side, helping fight behavioral health issues, addiction, things of that nature. So we have two special guests today, and I'll kick it off. First off, ladies first, we have Lauren Kost. Lauren's a behavioral health specialist for the IFF, a licensed mental health clinician, and is doing tremendous work at the IFF in helping our members stay healthy. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Pleasure to have you. Our next guest is, and I'm going to take a little liberty here, is somebody that has been a true supporter of mine for almost 20 years and has really helped me get to where I'm at. And I'm very appreciative. He's one of the smartest guys you are ever going to meet. And the work that he has done for our international on a local, state, and international level is beyond amazing. And now we're lucky to have him at headquarters. He's been with us for a little over a year. And this gentleman's name is Will Newton. He is a director of occupational health and behavioral health services in our health and safety division.
Good morning. Good morning. Thank you, Mark. You're too kind.
So as we mentioned, the IFF is always expanding its behavioral health services that is provided to members. You know, we have our Center of Excellence, which we're going to talk about. We have peer support training programs. We do a lot of things for our members. But more importantly, I think lately, is the outbreak of COVID-19. And while health and safety has done a tremendous job of making sure we have all the health precautions out there that we need, we have a tremendous COVID-19 toolkit. Other divisions and headquarters are now working on how locals are going to survive financially in a post-COVID-19 economy. You know, you're really focusing on the behavioral health issues that are out there. So since this has all started, what are some of the behavioral health issues that we're seeing in society, and not just society, but our membership?
I think we're experiencing this pandemic in so many different ways right now from a behavioral health perspective. If I had to sum it up, I'd say some of the main behavioral health issues and emotional issues we're seeing are really just an explosion of anxiety, fear, crippling uncertainty about the future, for some anger, for other people grief. The virus has really changed everything about how we as human beings work, educate, live, and just stay connected to each other. Seemingly overnight, the message from our leaders and public health experts has changed from don't panic. This is a disease that mostly affects the elderly or those with compromised immune states, to this is a deadly virus that can reach anyone and we should all be very concerned. So the threat of the virus, I think, has just left us all in a really heightened state of alert over the past couple months. I think everyone is feeling anxious about something while also trying to adjust to a really radically new way of life that leaves us feeling confined and isolated. I know parents, I'm a parent, we're all feeling anxious about homeschooling our kids and also trying to get our own work done at the same time. Low-income families that rely on the public school system may be struggling to put food on the table. Small business owners don't know when they're going to be able to reopen. And I also think that everyone has at least a few loved ones that fall into that high-risk immunocompromised group. So the fears about our loved ones contracting this virus are very valid and widespread. I think for IAFF members specifically, and other healthcare providers that are serving our communities on the front lines, there are a whole additional set of issues to consider that also trigger anxiety. So, of course, our firefighters and paramedics are used to risking their lives and safety every day when they go to work, and that's not anything new. But the sheer scope of the virus, combined with the lack of PPE in some communities, and the fact that the virus is still so new, I think, really creates a unique situation and a very anxiety-provoking situation that many of our members may not have countered in their careers before. So our members are struggling with questions like, do I have the right equipment to keep me safe on the job? Will I contaminate my family when I go home? Is my job secure and safe in this projected economic recession that our country is going to face? So every day our members are being asked to do more with less, while also adapting to so many changing protocols. And I think together, all of these stressors really build up and can have a serious impact on our mental health and physical health.
So, Lauren, let me ask you real quick. You talk about the stressors of responding to the pandemic, the stressors of the financial impact. I know there's a lot of firefighters that are working with their families to try to not bring the virus home. It's hard not to bring the stress home with you, no matter what PPE you're wearing. What do you suggest for our members out there who are trying to cope as best they can with all this anxiety for them and their families? How best can they make this work for them?
So I think the good news is that there really are so many things we can do to boost our resilience and our capacity to cope during this time from a mental health perspective. But before any of that, we need to focus on physically protecting ourselves from transmission, using evidence-based precautions. So managing that fear and anxiety comes in part from doing what we know works to protect ourselves physically when we're out there. So this means, of course, being incredibly vigilant about hand washing at home and at the station, wearing a mask in public, keeping that social distance, of course, utilizing the necessary PPE on shift, and following the proper donning and doffing procedures that are established by your department. Beyond some of these physical strategies, however, there really is a lot we can do to preserve our mental health. So it's really important to find at least one or two sources of trustworthy news information and really try to stick to that. So there's a lot of blurring today between the news and social media. So it's really critical that we get our facts directly from the source. And I think if you're someone that can get really sucked into the news cycle and push notifications on your phone, it's a good idea to consider turning off those push notifications or setting a limit on how often you're going to allow yourself to check the news media, because the news is such a major trigger for so many of us for anxiety. And it's also something that we have complete control over. We don't have to be checking it a million times a day. So
24/7 Twitter isn't my best way to get over this thing?
Is not, no.
And it's probably not a good strategy?
No. So we need to try to scale that back a little bit. And, every individual knows what's normal for them. But I like to say slashing that by 2/3. So whatever amount you think is okay to be, checking news reports all day, to really try to drastically cut that at least in half. Because I promise you, the essential and important information that you need to know is going to get to you either way, regardless of if you're checking the phone a million times a day. Also just exercise. So it's really important. I mean, we know this. This is pretty basic information that we've always known, that exercise not only improves our mood, but boosts our immune system, which is something that we all should be focused on right now, staying physically healthy. So finding something that you can do and stick with every day, getting outside, getting 20 minutes of some kind of physical movement every day, whether it's using an app-based exercise at home or just getting out in your neighborhood.
That's great information for our members. You know, cutting the news consumption is something I never really thought of, but it makes a lot of sense. I mean, I think everybody will test Mark and I probably haven't considered that near as much as we should. but so that's all really good stuff for our members. The stress I think a lot of us feel is we're at the firehouse and our families are at home. How do we best navigate that tricky situation with our spouse at home while we're at the firehouse on shift? You know, it's stressful for us to make these runs, but I guarantee the spouse at home is under just as much stress. How do we alleviate that so that we can have healthier relationships in the time that we do have at home?
So if you're a firefighter or paramedic that has a partner at home, I think it's really important to communicate with that partner at whatever frequency you normally would. What I think is really challenging for some families right now is that while our first responders are working their same schedule, or things might be business as usual for them, or they might even be working more shifts, the other partner is confined at home all day, often trying to homeschool one or more kids, and is also teleworking themselves. So in addition to worrying about the health and safety of their loved one on the front lines, they're also managing all these factors at home. So that's very stressful. So I think we really need to empower our spouses and partners that are at home to really set reasonable expectations for themselves and for their kids in terms of what they're going to be able to get done in the day. So keeping a really flexible attitude and encouraging that partner to take breaks whenever they're able to. So if there's an older child in the home that can keep an eye on the younger child while the parent takes a few minutes of quiet time in the bedroom. Parents that are at home also should check in with other parents during the day who are in the same boat that they are in to get some validation on how challenging this is and really how unique this situation is. I think, you know, above all, it's just so important that we all remember that this is not going to last forever. I saw an interesting comic the other day, and it was a conversation between a mom and her older kids. And the mom was asking, do you remember that the time of the coronavirus outbreak, do you think you were damaged forever? And the kids said something like, oh yeah, you mean that time that we all got to stay home together, sleep in, play a lot of board games, and our family got to eat dinner together every night. That was kind of cool. So I think we need to, you know, as parents and families, just be kind to ourselves right now, be flexible, have reasonable expectations. And just also remember that this might be a unique opportunity for some families to have some special time with their family.
You hit my nail on the head with be kind to one another. I think right now it's so easy to be overstressed, even, you know, in the work atmosphere, everywhere else, but especially at home. Just that extra time that we take to walk in each other's shoes, or just that kindness that we can pay one another, really, I think, amplifies throughout. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I think so. There's no playbook for this situation, so everyone is doing their best.
One of the things that we know is firefighters struggle more from alcohol and drug addiction probably than a whole lot of other professions. How does the COVID-19 pandemic and these stay-at-home orders really affect our members negatively as they're going through and trying to fight their addictions?
Yeah, this is a really challenging time for anyone in recovery from addiction. It just is. Stress levels are very high, liquor stores remain open, and most of us are coping with more unstructured downtime and isolated time than we ever have. So, of course, these are all triggers for use and relapse. Members that are in recovery, especially early stages of recovery, like 90 days of sobriety or less, need to get very creative to stay connected and supported during this time. If you're someone that has a sponsor, establish a regular time, a consistent time of the day to check in over video chat. Whether you attend Alcoholics Anonymous, Narcotics Anonymous, or Smart Recovery meetings, get to an online recovery meeting today. These organizations are hosting online meetings every day, multiple times throughout the day. There's always a meeting you can find to fit into your schedule. So that's one thing. Additionally, I think a little later in the podcast, we're going to talk about the online recovery meetings that the IFF is hosting. And these have become a really excellent way for IFF members to get connected, to support each other during this time, and to also have some accountability, I think, for their own recovery and self-care that we all should be practicing right now. If you're in recovery and battling that addiction and you find being home very stressful or being confined at home with family or spouse stressful, it's really important to communicate with your partner what you need. So don't expect your partner to know exactly what you need during this time. You have to tell them. Establish boundaries at home whenever you can. So it's okay to take walks outside to clear your head or to, you know, to take a few minutes of quiet time somewhere else in your house if you're able to. Lastly, just considering mental health treatment and counseling as well. So if mental health treatment is normally a part of your self-care plan and a part of your recovery plan and part of what keeps you on track with sobriety, it's really important that you continue that care right now. So ask your providers if they're able to do telehealth appointments, stay on top of any medication refills that you might need. And I think overall, just the most important thing is to remember that you're not alone. And there are others out there that are struggling just like you, but you have to reach out and ask for the help.
That'll conclude this edition of the IFF podcast. I encourage you to check us out online. We're available now in all of the stores for download.
Like we say every podcast, like, share, make sure that anybody you think that could use this information knows about it and give us feedback. We really want to know what you're thinking about how the podcast is going.
Thank you very much for listening, and stay safe out there.
Members of the Firefighters Health and Safety Division talking about how their members are dealing with the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on the latest IAFF podcast. Find them at IAFF.org/radio or your favorite podcast platform.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1972. That was the day that employees at the Farrah Manufacturing Company went out on strike. The company was one of the top producers of men's and boys' pants in the country, and the second largest employer in El Paso, Texas. The majority of workers were Chicano. More than 80% were women. These workers worked long hours for low wages and were required to meet a high quota demand. In the late 1960s, some of the male employees began to discuss their working conditions and what they could do to change things. One employee remembered the early days of organizing sometimes happened after softball games between the teams of workers from the different departments in the plant. We'd sit around after the game and talk about these things and the union. Men working in the cutting room voted to affiliate with the Amalgamated Clothing Workers of America. Workers from the San Antonio plant came to El Paso to support the union effort. These workers were fired. In response, 500 El Paso workers walked off the job. They demanded the right to have a union. Soon, more than 3,000 Farrah employees went out on strike. The strike cause won the support of the Roman Catholic bishop in El Paso, who supported a boycott against Farrah pants. The AFL-CIO called for a boycott. The campaign against Farrah soon spread across the country. Even though the company brought in scab replacement labor, the effort to get a union continued. The fight wore on until March of 1974, when the National Labor Relations Board found in favor of the employees who had been fired. Unionization had come to Farrah. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Our last show is from the Working People podcast, hosted by McKenna Alvarez. It's a podcast that bills itself as by, for, and about the working class today. And we've excerpted an episode that really shows this off, the second installment of their Workers' Book Club, featuring John Tormey, a track laborer and writer from just outside Boston, interviewing working class Kentucky artist, writer, and radio host Terry Tapp about his latest book, A Serf's Journal, the story of the United States' longest wildcat strike.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Working People, a podcast about the lives, jobs, dreams, and struggles of the working class today. Brought to you in partnership with In These Times magazine and supported entirely by listeners like you. Whoever you are, wherever you are, and, you know, whatever you're doing, we hope that this episode finds you and yours holding up okay. You know, as okay as any of us can be in these dark and uncertain times. You know, I know a lot of people out there are tuning in to try to, you know, just momentarily forget about what's going on outside our windows right now. So, you know, I want to just hop right into this very special episode that we've got for y'all today. But, you know, before that, I just wanted to take a quick second to say that, you know, we are sending nothing but love and solidarity to all of you, to all the workers putting their lives and health on the line right now and who are keeping society from collapsing. To the millions of people who are suddenly unemployed, furloughed, or just unscheduled. To all the vulnerable people out there who can't work. To everyone that this country has failed. We see you, and we're with you. And you deserve so much better than this. We all do. All right. Well, you know, like I said, I don't want to dwell too much on the fact that the world is breaking apart because, you know, I'm pretty sure that's what most of us are doing most hours of the day anyway. And, you know, I do want to stress how special today's episode is and how proud I am to share it with y'all. So, you know, longtime listeners may remember that we launched a new series last season called The Workers' Book Club. You know, we have a couple of different ongoing series right now. We've got our organized series where we talk to working people who have, you know, gotten involved in community organizing. There's the Workers' Toolkit series that we launched earlier this year. We've got our Working Class Politics and our Break the Chains mini-cast series. And, yeah, I mean, you know, we publish new installments of these ongoing series when we can. And, you know, I really enjoy it every time a new one comes out. But, you know, as a shameless bookworm and a, I guess, shameless devotee to lifting up the voices of our fellow workers, you know, I've always been really excited about the concept behind the Workers' Book Club. You know, if you go back in the catalog, you'll find the first installment that we did of this series. You know, it was a really great episode where I got to interview the brilliant historian and independent scholar, Carrie Lee Merritt, about, you know, this co-edited volume that she and Matthew Hild published with the University of Florida Press called Reconsidering Southern Labor History, Race, Class, and Power. And, you know, I explained the concept of the Workers' Book Club in that intro. But, you know, really, the concept is very simple. You know, we send a book to a worker. They read it, and then we record them interviewing the author, and we just see where it goes. And that's pretty much it. But, you know, we haven't published another installment of this series until now because, honestly, the logistics can be kind of a pain in the ass. You know, it can be more difficult than you'd expect to, you know, find the books, to get the authors to sign on to this, to get copies of the books to the workers, to coordinate, you know, everyone's schedules, yada, yada, yada. You know, and of course, you know, we know it's a lot to ask people who spend their weeks, you know, just working their asses off to still find time to read a book and record these conversations. But, you know, now that we are putting out the second installment of this series, I can happily say that it is absolutely 100% worth it. And, you know, I think the result kind of speaks for itself. So, you know, in this installment of the Workers' Book Club, we asked our buddy John Tormey, and John's actually been a guest on the show before. He is a track laborer and a union member from Boston. You know, he's a really great guy with just an amazing accent. And, you know, he's a really brilliant writer himself. So, you know, we reached out to John and we asked if he would read the latest book by working class artist and author Terry Tapp, who, by the way, is from Kentucky and also has an amazing accent. So you're going to get a treat of amazing accents in this episode. So Terry's new book is called A Serf's Journal, The Story of the United States' Longest Wildcat Strike. You know, it is published by Zero Books, and it's a really beautiful and stirring book. And I mean, I'd highly encourage folks to check it out and, you know, to check out all of the brilliant work that Terry does as an author, a visual artist, a radio host, and, you know, just a brilliant and compassionate thinker in general. You know, I am honored that both Terry and John agreed to do this episode. And I think anyone who listens to this show will really dig their work. And we've linked to some of their work in the show notes. And, you know, honestly, when I was listening to the conversation for this episode, I mean, I was so excited and just so, I don't know, proud of it. You know, it's so good. It's so good. And I'm so grateful to Terry and John for jumping just headfirst into it with such, you know, generosity and wit and care and honesty. You know, I really hope that we can do more of these episodes in the future. And, you know, like I said in the intro to the first installment of the Workers' Book Club, you know, if you are a worker yourself or an author or, you know, both, and, you know, you have an idea for another installment, then please reach out to us. You know, we are more than happy to offer this podcast up as a platform for these kinds of conversations. I mean, that's the whole deal, right? That's exactly what we want this podcast to be. And, you know, I know there isn't much to be hopeful about right now. But, you know, honestly, it does fill my heart to see more folks using different media, you know, their writing, videos, podcasts, Twitch streams, you know, folks using all sorts of different tools that they have available to them to bring more of our fellow workers in, to engage with and validate each other's lives and experiences. You know, this is what a grassroots, bottom-up, and more democratic and participatory media can actually look like. We have the tools to make the media that we want and that we need. And so, you know, without further ado, here is John Tormey talking to Terry Tapp about his latest book, A Serf's Journal, The Story of the United States' Longest Wildcat Strike.
Hey, it's John Tormey. I'm here to do the next installment of the Workers' Book Club for the Working People podcast. I'm going to be talking to Terry Tapp about his excellent book, A Serf's Journal, the story of the United States' longest wildcat strike from Zero Books. And I've asked Terry if he could read a short section. So, Terry, whenever you're ready.
All right, this is from page 9. At ground level, the world I lived in was an ugly gray road. warded with Walmarts and check cashing centers, fast food franchises and churches, car dealerships, strip bars, and gas stations. When I thought of that road stretching out forever, I wanted to evaporate, or to simply never have been born, never know there was anything else possible. Below the gray road, people were painting and drawing, playing music and dancing, writing, dreaming. They practiced another world, my world, hidden many fathoms beneath the cracking asphalt. I drove along the ugly road to get to the shipyard, and I wondered who decided things had to be this way. It wasn't me.
Fuck yeah, dude. That's when you got me.
Why did that affect you?
The number of shitty semi-highways, byways, whatever you want to call them, that I've driven down trying to find a job site or trying to find a spot to park next to the railroad tracks, I can't even fucking count.
Yeah, of course.
In every conceivable type of town around Massachusetts, it ain't exactly Kentucky or Indiana, but I recognize the street you were driving on.
The point is to look at people's lives who $10 could transform. Who, if you came up to them and said you have health care, or we're going to make sure that you have your rent paid or your mortgage paid for a year, which happens to a lot of people up here because they have, you know, they have parents of means. But down in Kentucky, if you have a week without pay, you may be wondering if you're going to be on the street or the road, so to speak. You know, and those people need a voice. Those people, you know, as I listened to the debates, for instance, I'm reminded of so many discussions I've had with people in shipyards and construction sites, in places like that, about politics. And you couldn't classify them, you know, within the partisan system of the United States, but they're clearly aware of what's going on. They don't see that they have any potential to have a voice in it, or as the quote, you know, the paragraph I read, like none of it's their choice, and they really want to back away from it. But they're very aware of what's going on, and they may have background prejudice, the, you know, bigotry of religious or racial sorts, misogyny, homophobia, that's prevalent in the U.S., but it's not pronounced. It's not what they step forward with. You know, there's a redneck guy, and I can call people this, but this guy was very redneck, and I was at the shipyard with him, and we were, it was a winter's day, and the covers on the hopper barges were full of snow, and it took a couple hours to get cranes and remove them, so we're hiding out, waiting on this, because there's nothing we can do, but we'll be chastised for doing the only thing we could, which is nothing. And there was something in the paper about environmental terrorism. And some friends of mine who were involved with ELF had done some things, and they were talking about it in the newspaper. And casually, the guy was looking over my shoulder. I looked back at him, and I said, "These aren't really terrorists." And he goes, "No, dude." And he points at the management building of the shipyard, and he said, "These people are the terrorists." The guy has no education. He comes from, I mean, I knew where he came from. It's out in the sticks. And he can pinpoint exactly who whom is our enemy.
Oh, I remember talking to somebody, the same thing, and I don't forget how we started talking about it, but talking about there's this color, there's that color as far as people's skin and everything like that, and he just, like, out of nowhere, he's like, green's the only color that fucking matters to these people. Like, it must have been right during the crash, but that just always stuck with me. So it just, the way, like, just like his lips starting to come up, and he'd never said anything like that before. He's like, green's the only thing that fucking matters to these fucking people.
It's such a mistake to think that people smell shit, basically. They don't understand that exactly what's going on. I've been in so many places where, you know, if you brought someone in who was well-educated and from an upper class, they would assume that that the people around them don't know what's really going on. They need to read Marx, or they need to read the New Republic, or, you know, whatever they're doing, The Nation. They need to have some understanding of class consciousness and all types of things. But the actual point is they already do. They just don't know what to do about it. You know, go ahead.
No, I just say, like, the thing that always bugged me about that's like, when you say, like, oh, these people need to read Marx, it's like, you guys get that Marx wasn't writing that to explain it to them. He was writing that to explain it to you.
Yeah, exactly.
They get that they're the ones who matter. They get that they're the, without them, it doesn't fucking happen.
Right.
Like, it's you guys that he needs to explain this to.
You know, my daughter was asking me, we were talking about, she's 18, and she was asking me about a lot of different situations I've been in. And she said, how did you get people to walk out? Because I've been on various walkouts, smaller strikes, and of course, a very long strike that the book is about. And I listened to her. I thought, you know, if you're talking to, she's talking to a lot of people her age, but she's also talking to people on social media who come from a bit of privilege. And it's a mystery how you get people to do anything. And I point out to her, I said, you know, in so many situations, people understand that you either swallow your dignity, you swallow your future, you know, you step on what's left of your own individuality and your own self-esteem, or you react. And the reaction may be to punch someone, it may be to walk out the door, it may be just to lay your tools down. It may be, there are various things, but at some point, when you're pushed to that wall, you either curl up or you act. And she's young enough where, of course, she's excused. She doesn't have to deal with that. But if you're looking at, you know, that story is not told in our culture now. You know, in the 70s, even, the Norma Rae, I mean, you have all types of little, you know, movies, books that talk about people who got pushed to the wall. And I wouldn't say acted heroically, but heroism tends to be necessity. It's not as grand as it looks from the inside.
John Tormey, a track laborer and writer from just outside Boston, interviewing working-class Kentucky artist, writer, and radio host Terry Tapp about his latest book, A Serf's Journal, the story of the United States' longest wildcat strike. On the Working People podcast, you can find it on your favorite podcast platform or at workingpeople.libsyn.com. It's a terrific podcast, and I especially urge you to check out this entire episode, which was published on April 6th, to hear the much longer interview between John and Terry. As podcast host McKenna Alvarez says, it's a real doozy. That's going to do it for this week's edition of Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed these highlights from labor radio and podcast shows around the country, part of the Labor Radio Podcast Network of shows that focus on working people's issues and concerns. We've got links and feeds for all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org. You can also find them by using the hashtag LaborRadioPod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this is Chris Garlock urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly is produced and mixed by me. Our social media guru is Harold Phillips, and you can always reach us at laborradionetwork.org.